Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. My name is Akash Nandache. I'm regular host for the Animal Studies channel. And today I'm joined by Dr. Michael B. Prince, who's associate professor at Boston University, and he'll be discussing his wonderful new book, The Shortest Way with Defoe, Robinson Crusoe, Deism, and the Novel. Dr. Prince, thank you so much for being here. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. It's a great delight to join you.
I had a great time reading this book, and it presents an innovative look at a true classic of English literature. And I thought that we could begin by discussing how your study differs from some of the historiography, some of the traditional readings of Robinson Crusoe. Could you please introduce your novel angle and also Charles Leslie, for those of our listeners unfamiliar with him, and his relationship with Defoe?
Oh, sure. I like to tell the story of how the book began. There's a funny scene in the movie by Woody Allen called Zelig, in which he's put under psychoanalysis to figure out why he's adopting so many personalities. And as he's hypnotized, and he admits under hypnosis that he never read Moby Dick, at which point the psychiatrist burst into laughter. And I was teaching Robinson Crusoe again for the 100th time about 2016, and realized that I had never read Robinson Crusoe, really. I mean, it's a trilogy. It has three parts, and people normally refer to Robinson Crusoe, they really mean only the first part. So I decided, what the hell, and I tackled the second and third parts, which I'd always heard were pretty bad, which they are. But at the beginning of the third part, I encountered a very strange passage. And in it, the narrator, who's our Crusoe, Robinson Crusoe, says of Don Quixote, the famous history of Don Quixote, a work which thousands read with pleasure to one that knows the meaning of it, was an emblematic history of and a just satire upon the Duke de Medina Sidonia, a person very remarkable at that time in Spain. I thought, well, that's funny. I'd never seen that in the scholarship. And then the passage continues, singling out a malicious and foolish writer who, in the abundance of his gall, spoke of the quixotism of our Crusoe, as he called it. He showed evidently that he knew nothing of what he said, and perhaps will be a little startled when I shall tell him that what he meant for a satire was the greatest of panegyrics. And that it really struck me that, first of all, Defoe seems to be making up a rumor that Don Quixote was entirely a satire written against one person. And I started asking around with Spanish scholars, you know, is this true? And they said, well, yeah, the Duke de Medina Sidonia was one of the enemies that Cervantes was attacking, but not the enemy. And then I started inquiring with the Defoe scholars, you know, what could this possibly mean? Is he suggesting that there was an enemy, a nemesis, on par with this Duke de Medina de Sidonia, who somehow was the origin of Robinson Crusoe? As the passage continues, he stops this line and says, well, we're not going to talk about this anymore, lest I give away the origin of the original, the origin being, as I understood it, the cause or the motivating factor for Robinson Crusoe, and the original being this nemesis that he's pointing to. So the scholars I asked about this all said it was not a real clue. And, you know, Robinson Crusoe is not a satire, and they just blew it off. But I decided to follow that clue. And in 2016, it wasn't so hard to imagine that hatred for one man might motivate an artist, you know, to create a masterpiece, or at least try. So I started looking into this more. I had been at work on a history of English deism before I encountered this clue, and happened to have read a work by Charles Leslie called A Short and Easy Method with the Deists. It came out in 1698 and quickly became very popular. And so the echo of the title, The Shortest Way with the Dissenters, which was a famous work that had gotten Defoe in tremendous trouble, got him pilloried and thrown in jail. And this short and easy method, it just struck me that maybe this Leslie guy was his nemesis. And so I started, following out that lead, more like an investigative reporter, or even a detective looking for clues to a murder, than maybe the traditional scholar. And this led me in directions that ran pretty much counter to the received scholarship on Defoe, because this person, Charles Leslie, who was the leader of the Jacobites at the time, that is the main intellectual, the most prolific, contentious polemicist supporting the banished Stuart succession. He was a very considerable person and an angry person. And it turned out that there were a lot of clues that linked Defoe to this man. And I was able to piece together a new history of Robinson Crusoe just by sort of following the clues where they led.
Thank you for that answer. This is primarily a tale of revenge and of a most subtle and gradual sort. I think it's worthwhile to explore the need for this subtlety on the part of Defoe, as on one hand, he's demonstrating his wit and spinning this impressive web, while on the other, he's dodging the licensing authorities and being attacked by some critics and going through pains to remain undiscovered. Could you expand on his predicament in this regard?
Sure. I think it's a predicament that artists today have encountered as well. I mean, how do you counter a truly hateful individual who's very powerful and who is simultaneously in control of sort of religious authority, political authority, and is also a resourceful writer? This was Charles Leslie, and he was a formidable adversary. So there is a tactical aspect of this question, and there's a famous response that he had to not Leslie but Jonathan Swift, where he's dealing with this issue. You know, how do you counteract the baneful influence of someone you despise without simultaneously writing like that person or sounding like that person? And again, I think it's a problem that artists today have really been struggling with. I thought I'd read a passage about Swift, but it applies to Leslie as well. He says, in pursuing an enemy that has neither acted the gentleman or the Christian, methinks no man ought to expect our keeping any rules. The question will be what way to deal with this man monster and with what weapons we must fight him. It is usually esteemed the most honorable way of fighting to beat a man, as they call it, at his own weapons, that is to take the same arms which his enemy is most master of. But I must be deprived of that honor. It can't be practiced here, for the adversary begins with lying, a weapon at which I acknowledge myself no match for him. Defoe's being ironic, of course. One critic, Paul Dotton, calls him a great liar, perhaps the greatest liar of all time. It's part of the difficulty of dealing with Defoe, is you just don't know where truth is or authenticity. But it does raise the issue of what kind of response to Leslie would be adequate to the challenge and would not mire Defoe in the same mud that his enemy was slinging. There is also, I think, a tactical question as regards safety. I mean, Leslie could attack Defoe openly. Leslie called for Defoe's punishment, he called for corporal punishment against Defoe. The reverse was not necessarily true. Defoe had to be much more circumspect about how he attacked. And we see this in the shortest way with the dissenters, where he actually impersonates his enemy so well that the enemy doesn't know it's being impersonated. And from there, oddly, he begins to defend the Quakers. And scholars have never known what to make of this, because the Quakers were known at the time as espousing a liberalized Protestant theology that was so much involved with the inner light, so much involved with private conscience, that for someone like Leslie, it didn't even pass as Protestantism anymore. It seemed more like a kind of proto-deism. In fact, the Quakers were thought of as deists. And yet Defoe defends the Quakers. So my question was, why is he doing that? Why is he impersonating Quaker ministers? And in his fiction, in Moll Flanders, there are sympathetic Quakers. In Roxana, there's a very important Quaker friend who saves Roxana's life from an irate daughter. Captain Singleton, there's a dear friend who's a Quaker. Well, in my reading, the Quakers provided him cover, where he could attack Leslie on theological grounds, but all the while say that, look, it's just a Quaker. It's just a Quaker. And I call this an act of camouflage deism, or deism in allegorical disguise, or I sometimes call it literary deism. And so the question became, to carry out this revenge, what other forms of literary deism did Defoe deploy? And that made it possible to cut through the hundreds and hundreds of works he wrote between Shortest Way with the Dissenters and Robinson Crusoe, and look for other acts of literary deism. There are two notable ones. They're both long prose fictions, and both were called novels in their own day. In other words, Defoe wrote two novels before the novel, Robinson Crusoe. The first is modeled on a lunar voyage by Lucian. Lucian was a second century Syrian Greek satirist who was known as an atheist, suspected of being a homosexual, and very much anti-Christian. He had undergone a revival of interest in the 17th century. There were a lot of Lucian imitations and translations. So Defoe was sort of perpetuating a tradition of satire that was prevalent in his day. Cyrano de Bergerac also wrote A Voyage to the Moon. And these works were known for their libertine deism. We would now say cosmopolitanism, because on the moon, of course, many different views are possible. That was the first effort, and Charles Leslie is under constant attack in The Consolidator. That's the name of this first work, 1705, 16 months after he gets out of Newgate Prison, he writes this long prose fiction. So that became chapter two, and then the question was, what else? You know, and it was obvious that he had written another long prose fiction called A Continuation of Letters Written by a Turkish Spy at Paris. And this was a continuation of a work that was very popular in the 17th century, originally composed by Giovanni Paolo Marana in France. It was supposedly written in Italian and then translated into English. But then he was kept from writing more editions because it was religiously questionable. He was blocked by the Inquisition. But there was a claim that there were more volumes of this. In fact, eight more volumes of it appeared during the period from around 1690s and 1690s. Defoe was already late 20s, early 30s at that time. And here is another work associated with cosmopolitanism, quite radical in its religious questioning. It involves a Muslim named Mahmoud, who is a spy on the West living in Paris. It too was accused of cosmopolitanism and deism. So here's Defoe imitating these two works, proto-novels, both deists, and also getting in trouble for them. They were disguises that weren't disguised enough. So my reading of Robinson Crusoe is that it's continuous with these cosmopolitan and deistical early novels, but much better disguised. By the time he takes on the trappings of a Protestant spiritual autobiography, run by Protestants, notions of providence, it doesn't look deistical at all anymore, except to his enemies. They too saw through the mask of Robinson Crusoe. So the revenge is subtle and indirect, And so subtle, you might say, that no one's picked up on it for 300 years. I guess your listeners should realize that this view of Robinson Crusoe as a disguised satire is not widely shared.
Perhaps not yet, but it's quite remarkable. And on this topic of camouflage and disguise, it begs the question of mode, and clearly metaphor and allegory are extremely important to Defoe, and as well as his critics. And I couldn't help but notice, given my own research interests, how within these metaphors, there's an abundance of human animal associations, as there are in many 18th century writings. And I wondered if animals or are there other themes that help Defoe in particular disguise his attacks that he might have had an affinity for?
Oh, that's a lovely question. It's the sort of question that draws an author's attention to aspects of the book that he perhaps wasn't fully aware of. But now that you mention it, there are a hell of a lot of animals here. Yeah. Starting with the cover of the book, I decided to put on the cover a illustration that an artist, a Swiss artist named Dumoulin, drew in around 1810. And he picked up on the scenes at the end of part one, where Crusoe and his party, including Friday, are trekking across the Pyrenees, and they run into a freak snowstorm. And they're attacked by a ravenous wolf and a lumbering bear. And critics have never known what to make of this. One scholar I read from an ecological point of view sort of complained that Defoe was really hard on animals and that was just making fun of this gratuitous animal killings at the end, just as a sort of a lark, so to speak, and just to, you know, end the book on a amusing note. And in fact, Friday is trying to amuse his party when he lures the bear up into a tree, out onto a thin branch, lets himself down, and as the bear shimmies down the trunk, he shoots the bear in the head. But I, you know, starting from the premise of revenge, I couldn't help but wonder whether this wolf, who's shot just before the killing of the bear, and then the bear, might be figures for human beings that Defoe hated. And sure enough, I mean, if you follow out the story, the use of animals to attack people in a polemical context was quite frequent, as it is today. I mean, think about scoundrels who refer to women by their, you know, as dogs and this sort of thing. We hear this all the time, even at the highest echelons. And so it's a common practice. And certainly Defoe was subject to a tremendous amount of this kind of thing. Leslie called him a wolf over and over. Leslie wrote a piece called "The Wolf Stripped of Its Shepherd's Clothing," drawing on the biblical analogies. But the wolf was Defoe, and the shepherd's clothing was his Quaker mask. And the idea was, if you strip the wolf of his shepherd's clothing, you turn up the deist. That's what Leslie thought. Leslie also attacked William Penn in a piece called "The Snake in the Grass." So he had transformed this eminent early Quaker into a snake. Leslie wrote one called "Salt for the Leech." Lovely. And so Defoe got him back, you might say, by transforming Leslie into a wolf at the end. And the bear is someone named Henry Sacheverell. When The Shortest Way with the Dissenters came out and Defoe was trying to defend himself, he said, "What did you want me to do? Write on the cover as the Dutch do, with an arrow saying, 'This is the man and this is the bear.'" And also there is the Barabbas, the biblical thief who was arrested with Christ, and the crowd granted clemency to Barabbas and crucified Christ. And Defoe draws that analogy as well, because Defoe was imprisoned and pilloried. Henry Sacheverell was celebrated in 1710 for a sermon that had also caused him to be put on trial. So Barabbas, bear. Defoe was also a poet, so he heard these sounds. So there is an element of use of animals in this polemical context. But I think, Akash, that you might be, I think you're probably referring to more sympathetic depictions of animals in Robinson Crusoe. And it is really important to note that. I mean, Crusoe's all alone, right? And animals for him are tremendously important. He rescues a dog from the wreck and two cats. And the dog is with him for something like, I think he says 15 or 16 years. He was a very pleasant, loving companion to me for no less than 16 years of my time, and then died of mere old age. You get these stories of actual castaways who go crazy after like 18 months. You know, he's there for what, 28 years. But the animals helped him. Remember, he befriends a parrot. I saw abundance of parrot and fain would have caught one to have kept it to be tame and taught it to speak to me. So he catches a young parrot and brings it home. But it was some years before I could make him speak. And then he teaches him to call him by his name. And this is Pole, of course. And you go through in these, but it's, you know, and then you want to kind of theorize that and say, okay, animals stand for X. Either they're the polemical figures or they're figures of sympathy. But remember, when he meets Friday, he's trying to impress Friday with the power of his gun. And he sees a parrot in a tree and he just shoots the parrot, kills the parrot, so Friday could see how powerful the gun is. So, you know, one parrot he befriends, another he just kills gratuitously. And the same goes for, you know, goats and sheep. He's clothing himself with the skin of goats. He makes a parasol with the goat skin. He makes a vest with the goat skin. But he has a goat that he trains up from a kid that follows him around all the time. And I guess I would say from that there is no clear allegorical way that animals work in Robinson Crusoe, as you might have, say, in an Aesop's Fable or Orwell's Animal Farm. There's no one-to-one correlation. Sometimes they're very real. It's just a goat or a dying old goat, you know, in a cave. And you're free to interpret that dying old goat, for instance, as meaning more than it just some poor dying animal that he finds, as maybe standing for a figure for him, a kind of memento mori, a kind of reminder that he'll probably die the same way. Or it's just an animal. And I think that's why scholars miss the clue with the wolf and the bear at the end. The way it's depicted, these are just, these are just animals that they came upon in a realistic sense. One scholar points to the fact that in the winter of 1718, just before Robinson Crusoe came out, the newspapers report that there were actual snowstorms, freak snowstorms in the Pyrenees. So the realism suggests, of course, the animals would be coming out and they'd attack the party. It's all realism. And yet, if you read it my way, these are also metamorphosed figures for Defoe's greatest hatreds. So,
yeah. And surely one aspect also is that this is part of the entertainment for the readers. This is part of the travel narrative and what's so extraordinary about the story. And building off that, you've mentioned how he was pilloried and how his adversaries have more tangible threats to levy against him. But Defoe nonetheless remains exceptionally popular. And this bothers Leslie, and I think even you mentioned it bothers Swift at some point. So how is it that he remains so popular, and how conscious is he of his popularity?
There is a fascination with his ability to command voices. I'm sorry, I think that's my... that even his enemies, when they think about him, describe him as a kind of modern-day Homer, for his ability to impersonate different characters and personae. If that's the case, then they're sort of being drawn into the reading despite themselves. They want to hate the guy. They want to suspect every word that he writes. And yet there's something, I would say, non-doctrinal, non-ideological about the way it's never really possible to say, here's Defoe. Defoe and Crusoe are the same. When Crusoe performs his, you know, when he sells Zuri into slavery, or when he begins to colonize the island in part two and trust the Catholic missionary to convert all the natives to Catholicism. This you might say, okay, we found the real Defoe. He's a colonialist. He's an ideologue. He's a kind of apologist for nation capitalism. And yet, then you get critics reading the same works, and they say, well, not so fast. It's not Defoe that's selling Jury into slavery. He's depicting this character selling Jury into slavery. And when Friday comes on the scene, Crusoe's efforts to convert him to Protestantism are, you know, moderately successful. But of course, Friday asks that telling question, you know, why God no put the devil in hell? Which Crusoe pretends not to hear and says, what'd you say? I didn't quite hear that. Well, who's the author who's writing of the protagonist, the first person protagonist, that he pretends not to hear a difficult theological question? There has to be a space, in other words, between the author, the narrator, the protagonist. And in that space, I think, there is the openness for multiple interpretations and different views. And that, I think, is part of the appeal. He's also just a great storyteller and a great realist.
Yeah.
He's willing to impersonate the life of a courtesan, you know, Roxana, a high-class prostitute, you might say. This wasn't usually done. Eliza Haywood does it some, but for a male author to write so convincingly the life experience of a woman who must prostitute herself and is extraordinarily beautiful and ends up, you know, in France, in the court of France, this kind of sympathetic evocation of damaged lives is just constantly interesting.
And you've just touched on the space that he creates, and that space is also important as far as the question of deism in the novel and how Robinson Crusoe, while you mentioned it often masquerades as a pious work, Defoe isn't, you know, synonymizing. He's not synonymous with Crusoe, and he in fact allows for religious ambiguity and spiritual conflict within the novel. And in chapter 5, you discuss some of his religious persuasions more in depth, and I wonder if you could maybe expand on some of those.
Sure. Well, here too, I run counter to most of the accepted scholarship on this question. The accepted view is that Defoe was born into a family of Protestant dissenters in the 17th century. He's born in roughly 1660. There's some doubt about that. He was educated in a dissenting academy, trained for the ministry as a dissenting minister, and then decided not to go that way. When the question becomes which particular version of Protestant dissent he's closest to, the usual answer the scholars provide is that he's something like a moderate dissenter, moderate as in still being Trinitarian, still believing in the Trinity and wanting a reconciliation with the high church. So he's not a Quaker, he's not a Unitarian, certainly not a deist. And I think it's important to remember that because it does explain the Calvinist readings of Robinson Crusoe, which call it basically an updated Pilgrim's Progress for the economic man. Theologically orthodox dissent, that's the usual phrase. But if you come at it from the direction of the attack on Charles Leslie and ask, you know, how far was he willing to go to attack this hater of Jews, Muslims, Quakers, Unitarians, and this same hater could name the principle that united all these people, namely their anti-Trinitarianism, then it seems to me not so easy. And the clues that suggest a more radical religious orientation or non-orientation then stand out for me. I'll just read you a passage that gives this sort of so the usual view, someone like Martin Greif, far from the account of a practical man's adjustment to life on a deserted island, Robinson Crusoe is the record of a notable spiritual pilgrimage across the sea of life, from a lawless course of living to true Christian repentance, a symbolic voyage from sin and folly to the gift of God's grace attained through the sincere belief in Jesus Christ. And yes, I mean, there's plenty of evidence for that. His disobeying his father, which he calls his original sin, then the shipwreck, which is his punishment, and then the atonement for many years. It follows the path of a providential allegory. And so that's a plausible reading. If you're an enemy of Defoe in 1719, like Charles Gildon, or an Anglican minister in England and America named Checkley, John Checkley, you just don't read it that way. You're picking up on a different set of cues, which suggest a far more unorthodox and even deistical take on religion. And I just mention, take Jonah, for instance. Right at the beginning of the book, there are two shipwrecks before the big shipwreck. And after the second one, Crusoe meets the captain of the ship that has just gone down and has to admit that he was just on board as kind of a lark. He was just trying to see if he'd like to go to sea. And the captain of the ship gets irate at him and says, you know, what are you, some sort of a Jonah figure, Jonah of Tarshish? I don't want you on my ship ever again. I'd rather die than sail with you again. And so Defoe consciously evokes the story of Jonah. Well, think of that as working two ways. At the time, the Jonah story, which comes from the Hebrew Bible, would have been recognizable as an allegory for Christ. That is, the Protestant ministers at the time referred to Jonah as the antitype of Christ. Christ obeyed God's command, and Jonah refused God's command. Jonah was in the belly of the whale. Christ was buried for 3 days, etc. So there are all these typological connections that would justify the references to Jonah. But if you follow it further and look at the way the deists respond to Jonah at the time, someone like the third Earl of Shaftesbury in the Miscellaneous Reflections, he loves the Jonah story. And why does he love it? He loves it because Jonah talks back to God, that there's a almost human dialogue between Jonah and God. Jonah says, now, why should I go and warn these people? You're just going to forgive them, and I'm going to look like a fool. And God says back, you know, well, you better go. Sort of this one-on-one little tete-a-tete. And that's what the deists like. They like that it's a droll, witty story of dialogue, and almost the Buber sense of dialogue between man and God, or human beings and God. And my claim would be, you don't have to decide between those two. That the artistry of the book is poising these two possible Jonahs, the Christian type and the deist countertype. It's not an anti-type, really. It's a countertype which sets the entire structure of Christian allegory in a different frame. So that suggests to me a kind of complicated relation to religion, and I think it continues even into Moll Flanders and Roxana. Moll Flanders undergoes her, you know, confession and reprieve at the end. But is it believable? Is it really a religious awakening that she discovers? So those were some of the reasons. And then, of course, just following and taking a little more seriously what Defoe's enemies said. And I'll just read you Charles Gildon's response to Robinson Crusoe. It's an amazing attack. It came out the same year as the first two parts of Robinson Crusoe in 1719. He says, but when I found that you were not content with the many absurdities of your tale, but seemed to discover a design which proves you as bad an Englishman as a Christian, I could not but take notice in this public manner of what you had written, especially when I perceived that you threatened us with more of the same nature. If by this I can prevent another accession of impieties and superstition to those which the work under our consideration has furnished us with, I shall not think my labor lost. Gildon's normally taken as this jealous wannabe novelist who didn't succeed. He got syphilis and apparently had well, blindness for sure, but also a degree of insanity. So it was syphilitic insanity and jealousy that prompted this religious attack on Robinson Crusoe. But I'm inclined to take these attacks more seriously and try to figure out why Defoe's enemies thought he was so dangerous on religious grounds.
Yes, and is part of it the interaction and his awareness for Orientalist modes and styles and models? You've mentioned the Turkish spy, but I wondered if how that plays into your research here.
Yeah. As an artist, he's looking for models to expand the potential of the shortest way mode of narrative onto a larger canvas. And these Orientalist and cosmopolitan fictions were doing the same thing. They too were written either in a Catholic context or a Protestant context, where the authors had to disguise their critiques of theology, theocracy, and the political union of church and state. They had to disguise those things in imaginary voyages, in the case of The Voyage to the Moon, or in a kind of spy novel where all the satire against the church is voiced by a Muslim who's sort of desperate to go home. And so, yeah, I think that he became very adept at impersonating voices and forms that would protect him from being sort of outed as a religious radical. But also that these were very popular forms of prose fiction at the time and available as a model for someone with real artistic ambitions, which I think he had. There's another aspect to this, which I think goes beyond intention. And I bring it up in the fifth chapter with reference to Eric Auerbach and mimesis. In the eighth chapter of mimesis, Auerbach deals with Dante and the Inferno. And he isolates a couple of passages in which Dante depicts the suffering of people he knew, a former teacher, people he loved, and people he, fictional characters he admired. And according to Auerbach, the poetry depicts this suffering with such a degree of human intensity and realism that it overcomes the allegory. That is, it breaks the allegory. And the famous line for an Auerbach is that the image of man eclipsed the image of God. That's not a statement about intention, I don't think. And I wouldn't say that Defoe intended to be a cosmopolitan, Orientalist, religious radical. But it's a statement about art and the quest for an answerable form that would overcome the tendency to become ideological and polemical. You might say overcome the almost necessity of opining and of being recognizable, of taking a stand, so that when the image of man eclipses the image of God, it's a moment where the incipient realism and humanism of the next age is canceling or modifying the structure of the Catholic allegory that Dante inherits. And I would say the same thing about Defoe and Robinson Crusoe, that yes, it can be read as a spiritual autobiography like Pilgrim's Progress. There are these moments, though, that exceed that framework and break it. Whether Defoe intended that, whether he wants to be read as I'm reading him, as his enemies read him too, that, you know, I'm not sure I'd want to make that argument, but.
Dr. Prince, it's been such a pleasure discussing the book with you. And I did want to kind of ask this last question as, are you planning on continuing research on Robinson Crusoe, or Are there other works that you're working on, other mysteries that you're solving?
That's such a nice question. Thank you for that. Well, you can imagine my amusement when I discovered that a book that came out in April of 2020 in the midst of the pandemic doesn't even have Defoe's Journal of the Plague Year in the index. I don't even mention it. It came out in 1722. It's after Crusoe, but I think there's room for a couple of chapters, certainly, on the Journal of the Plague Year and Roxana. I had been at work on a long history of English deism when I thought I was taking up one chapter on Defoe, and that's when I ran into that clue. And I constantly had to backfill the history of deism to tell the story because it hasn't really been written. There's not a good account that takes you from Lord Herbert of Cherbury, roughly in the 1620s, to George Eliot, the first translator of Spinoza's Ethics. And that accounts for, say, the influence of Spinoza in English literature and the kinds of proto-deism that you have in some of the important philosophers and novelists. So that's what I was going to return to. And certainly there'll be something on the Journal of the Plague Year.
I look very forward to reading it. And Dr. Prince, thank you so much for taking time to speak with us. To our listeners, thank you. And the book is The Shortest Way with Defoe, Robinson Crusoe, Deism, and the Novel. Dr. Prince.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks.
Great honor.